says Lord Verulam, that's to say Sir Francis Bacon, as for the pedagogic part, consult the schools of the Jesuits, for nothing better has been put in practice. They raised the level of intelligence, they quickened the conscience of all Catholic Europe, they stimulated Protestant Europe to competitive educational efforts. Some day, it may be, we shall see a new order of Jesuits, vowed not to the service of the Pope, but to the service of mankind. And, concurrently with this great wave of educational effort, the tone and quality of the Church was also greatly improved by the clarification of doctrine and the reforms in organization and discipline that were made by the Council of Trent. This council met intermittently, either at Trent or Bologna, between the years 1545 and 1563, and its work was at least as important as the energy of the Jesuits in arresting the crimes and blunders that were causing state after state to fall away from the Roman Communion. The change wrought by the Reformation within the Church of Rome was as great as the change wrought in the Protestant churches that detached themselves from the mother body. There are henceforth no more open scandals or schisms to record, but if anything, there's been an intensification of doctrinal narrowness and such phases of imaginative vigor as are represented by Gregory the Great, or by the group of popes associated with Gregory the Seventh and Urban the Second, or by the group that began with Innocent the Third, no longer enliven the sober and pedestrian narrative. The World War of 1914 to 1918 was a unique opportunity for the papacy. The occasion was manifest for some clear, strong voice proclaiming the universal obligation to righteousness, the brotherhood of men, the claims of human welfare over patriotic passion. No such moral lead was given. The papacy seemed to be balancing its traditional reliance upon the faithful Habsburgs against its quarrel with republican France. Sixth. The reader mustn't suppose that the destructive criticism of the Catholic Church and of Catholic Christianity and the printing and study of the Bible were the only or even the most important of the intellectual activities of the 14th and 15th centuries. That was merely the popular and most conspicuous aspect of the intellectual revival of the time. Behind this conspicuous and popular awakening to thought and discussion, other less immediately striking but ultimately more important mental developments were in progress. Of the trend of these developments, we must now give some brief indications. They had begun long before books were printed, but it was printing that released them from obscurity. We've already told something of the first appearance of the free intelligence, the spirit of inquiry and plain statement in human affairs. One name is central in the record of that first attempt at systematic knowledge, the name of Aristotle. We've noted also the brief phase of scientific work at Alexandria. From that time onward, the complicated economic and political and religious conflicts of Europe and Western Asia impeded further intellectual progress. These regions, as we've seen, fell for long ages under the sway of the Oriental type of monarchy and of Oriental religious traditions. Rome tried and abandoned a slave system of industry. The first great capitalistic system developed and fell into chaos through its own inherent rottenness. Europe relapsed into universal insecurity. The Semite rose against the Aryan and replaced Hellenic civilization throughout Western Asia and Egypt by an Arabic culture. All Western Asia and half of Europe fell under Mongolian rule. It's only in the 12th and 13th centuries that we find the Nordic intelligence struggling through again to expression. We then find in the growing universities of Paris, Oxford, and Bologna an increasing amount of philosophical discussion going on. In form, it's chiefly a discussion of logical questions. As the basis of this discussion, we find part of the teachings of Aristotle, not the whole mass of writings he left behind him, but his logic only. Later on, his work became better known through the Latin translations of the Arabic edition annotated by Averroes. Except for these translations of Aristotle, and they were abominably bad translations, very little of the Greek philosophical literature was read in Western Europe until the 15th century. The creative Plato, as distinguished from the scientific Aristotle, was almost unknown. Europe had the Greek criticism without the Greek impulse. Some Neoplatonic writers were known, but Neoplatonism had much the same relation to Plato that Christian Science has to Christ. It's been the practice of recent writers to decry the philosophical discussion of the medieval schoolmen as tedious and futile. It was nothing of the sort. It had to retain a severely technical form because the dignitaries of the church, ignorant and intolerant, were on the watch for heresy. It lacked the sweet clearness, therefore, of fearless thought. It often hinted what it dared not say, but it dealt with fundamentally important things. It was a long and necessary struggle to clear up and correct certain inherent defects of the human mind, and many people today blunder dangerously through their neglect of the issues the schoolmen discussed. This is a natural tendency in the human mind, to exaggerate the differences and resemblances upon which classification is based, to suppose that things called by different names are altogether different, and that things called by the same name are practically identical. This tendency to exaggerate classification produces a thousand evils and injustices. In the sphere of race or nationality, for example, a European will often treat an Asiatic almost as if he were a different animal, while he'll be disposed to regard another European as necessarily as virtuous and charming as himself. He will, as a matter of course, take sides with Europeans against Asiatics. But as the reader of this history must realize, there's no such difference as the opposition of these names implies. It's a phantom difference created by two names. The main medieval controversy was between the realists and the nominalists, and it's necessary to warn the reader that the word realist in medieval discussion has a meaning almost diametrically opposed to realist as it's used in the jargon of modern criticism. The modern realist is one who insists on materialist details. The medieval realist was far nearer what nowadays we should call an idealist, and his contempt for incidental detail was profound. The realists outdid the vulgar tendency to exaggerate the significance of class. They held that there was something in a name, in a common noun, that is, that was essentially real. For example, they held there was a typical European, an ideal European, who was far more real than any individual European. Every European was, as it were, a failure, a departure, a flawed specimen of this profounder reality. On the other hand, the nominalist held that the only realities in the case were the individual Europeans, that the name European was merely a name and nothing more than a name applied to all these instances. Nothing is quite so difficult as the compression of philosophical controversies which are by their nature voluminous and various and tinted by the mental colours of a variety of minds. With the difference of realist and nominalist stated boldly as we've stated it here, the modern reader unaccustomed to philosophical discussion may be disposed to leap at once to the side of the nominalist. But the matter isn't so simple that it can be covered by one instance, and here we have purposely chosen an extreme instance.